Hear that? No, no, don't reach into your pockets. That's not your phone vibrating. The dull hums that you just heard are the mating calls of the great Indian bustard, the tragic hero of our story today. Now, the great Indian bustard, or GIB, is a beautiful big bird. It looks like an ostrich, stands about 1 meter tall, and is one of the heaviest amongst flying birds. It wears a natural black crown on its head, which contrasts with its white face and neck and sand-colored plumage. And just like authentic, honest-to-goodness tragic heroes today, the GIB is a critically endangered species. And like all tragedies, this story also has a central conflict, and it comes from the GIB's extremely concentrated habitat. Once found across Pakistan and the Indian states of Punjab, Haryana, Uttar Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh, Chhattisgarh, Odisha, Andhra Pradesh, Rajasthan, Gujarat, Maharashtra, Karnataka, and Tamil Nadu, the bird is now primarily found in the Thar scrublands and Kutch regions around Rajasthan and Gujarat. Now, Rajasthan and Gujarat, these states happen to be the central nodes of renewable energy generation in India. With an installed capacity of 26,800 megawatts of renewable energy and an actual production that soared 3 times in the last 4 years, Rajasthan is leading the renewable energy story in India. It's closely followed by Gujarat, which, with its upcoming mega energy park, may overtake Rajasthan in the next couple of years. Now, why is this critical? Because this is exactly what poses a danger to the great Indian bustard. How? Transmission lines. Overhead power transmission lines that crisscross the length and breadth of the states, carrying power from the plants to the people. Now, the problem is these birds are not great flyers, and they have their eyes to the ground while flying. So, they often fly into these transmission lines and are killed. And each death is a critical deduction from their number, which is now reduced to just about 150 odd birds. Now, a legal tussle on this issue has been ongoing since 2021 in the Supreme Court between wildlife conservationists and renewable power companies. While there's no resolution to the tussle yet, earlier this month, the case took a very interesting turn. On April 5th, the Supreme Court made a judgment. It recognized the right against the adverse effects of climate change as a fundamental right. It was a landmark judgment. In their arguments, CJI Chandrachud and Justices J.B. Pardiwala and Manoj Mishra said, and I quote, "Despite governmental policy and rules and regulations recognizing the adverse effects of climate change and seeking to combat it, there is no single or umbrella legislation in India which relates to climate change and the attendant concerns. However, this does not mean that the people of India do not have a right against the adverse effects of climate change." The judges also said, and I quote again, "Article 21 recognizes the right to life and personal liberty, while Article 14 indicates that all persons shall have equality before law and the equal protection of laws. These articles are important sources of the right to a clean environment and the right against the adverse effects of climate change." In this episode, we try and unravel this whole story, starting from the tussle between the protectors of the great Indian bustard and renewable energy firms, two groups that should ideally be on the same side of the climate and environment debate, but are at loggerheads in this case. We also analyze this newly declared fundamental right. Whose right is it? How does one exercise this right? In the absence of climate laws in India, does it provide any tangible protection to humans and animals that are impacted by climate change? Or is it just a first step in India's slow journey to becoming a stronger voice in climate litigation across the world? All this and more in today's episode. It's the 16th of April from the Economic Times. I'm your host, Anirban Chaudhary. This is the Morning Brief.
I believe that no species should go extinct. If any species now goes extinct, I will deem it to be allowed to go extinct because we know how to stop it. But if the great Indian bustard goes extinct, I regret to say, I will have to call it driven to extinction, because we know and we are deliberately not taking steps to stop it.
That's Dr. M.K. Ranjit Singh, the man who started the fight to protect the great Indian bustard. The man who set off the chain of events that led to the Supreme Court's landmark judgment.
And that is a sad part, because the Constitution of India enjoins upon the government and the that who shall protect forest and wildlife in the fundamental duties as well as in the fundamental principles of state policy.
An IAS officer who belongs to a royal family in Saurashtra, Dr. Ranjit Singh is one of the strongest forces behind wildlife conservation in India. He co-wrote the 1972 Wildlife Protection Act, was an integral part of the team that formed Project Tiger, and is widely known as the Cheetah Man for his work in preservation of the wild cat. In 2019, he filed a petition asking, among other things, for all future power transmission lines in the area that was the GIB's habitat to be laid underground instead of overhead.
I watched the bustard go extinct, and it's not just the bustard. It's everything that goes with it. The desert, you see, the most threatened species are grassland species, and those that we expect in open land, not under the cover of forest. So we wanted to say that here was an obvious cause given, that up to 18 birds or 80% of them are being killed by one cause, which is overhead lines. Now, there are two parts of it. It is undeniable that we need alternate energy and eco-friendly source of energy. We need to move away. We are all environmentalists. But my question is, can we meet our needs only by covering up the remaining habitat of the 100-odd bustards which still survive in this country? Is that quid pro quo? Is that an either-or situation? There are other alternatives. Of solar panels, and there are two aspects of it, overhead lines and solar panels. Solar panels, I will come to first. Do we have to cover up the entire area? An area where the bustard today survives and where it should go. Today, we've got a prioritized area where the 100-odd survive or fly to. And we need to expand, because we don't want to keep it down to 100. And it's not just for the sake of the bustard. What about grazing areas for the local pastoral communities? The rural population of Jaisalmer and Thar Desert is mainly dependent upon, was and still is, on animal husbandry. What about grazing rights? What about the sacred groves of the Bishnoi community, the Orans? Look, Gujarat has done a magnificent job of covering its water canals with solar panels, and it has multiple advantages, including water, including cleaning, including not having to acquire any land. Why don't they do it through the 900 kilometers of water canals which are running through the desert of Rajasthan, where you need to save water? You require huge quantities of water to clean it. Is that green technology? Is that green application to waste water? That is water which comes from the subsoil, which should be for drinking water purposes of human beings and their livestock. We're using it to clean solar panels. We have to take that factor into account too.
But sir, what about laying transmission lines underground? Surely that's a really difficult proposition.
It can be taken underground. It's not being taken because of financial reasons.
Right.
2% of what these people earn, which is a basic requirement under CSR law, would save the great Indian bustard from extinction. Can't we ask them to provide 2% of their earnings to underground those? There's enough obfuscation. Ye nahi ho sakta, wo nahi ho sakta, ho sakta. And we have proved it in court. We have submitted proof that it can be done.
In response to Dr. Ranjit Singh's writ petition, the Supreme Court in 2021 restricted the setting up of overhead transmission lines. It also appointed a committee to see how feasible it was to lay underground high voltage lines on a case-to-case basis.
In 2021, when this judgment came, a lot of developers, people like us in the industry, were really surprised because, you know, it was like a, like, wait, what just happened kind of a moment.
That's Shravan Sampath. Shravan is a renewable energy sector professional with 18 years of industry experience with large Indian corporates and leading global renewable energy majors such as Reliance, Equis Funds Group, Ampere Energy, and Brookfield.
Because a lot of developers were not involved in the petition to begin with. In fact, no developers involved. And surprisingly, not even the Ministry of Renewable Energy was involved in the hearings. So the entire, the larger cause of green energy was not represented in the writ petition to begin with. So what happened suddenly in the middle of 2021 is like, it was like a really big moment where we realized that, guess what? The biggest capacities that we expected that will come in this country from renewable energy are not going to happen because there's this bird called the GIB. And this bird is endangered, right? So this is exactly what happened mid-2021.
So according to the initial Supreme Court order, plans to set up transmission lines in over 99,000 square kilometers of area would have to be reviewed.
The problem that we were facing, in a sense, was not just that there was a large region of 99,000 square kilometers on which an embargo had been placed. So the problem was that the Supreme Court had identified two separate categories. The first was called a priority area. The priority area was one where the GIB's habitat needed to be protected at any cost. The other was called the GIB potential area. So if you talk to experts, a lot of them tell you that that was the area through which the GIB would fly. But those were not the actual areas where the GIBs would either breed or grow or live. GIB potential was a very big problem. Because if you look at the priority area, out of this 99,000 square kilometer, the priority area was only 13,000 square kilometers. So it was only 13% was the priority area. Potential area was 78,000 and additionally important areas was another 6,000 square kilometers. Right? So we're talking about almost reduction of the zone by 87%.
To understand why this 87% embargo is so critical, we have to understand the importance of Rajasthan and Gujarat for renewable energy players.
So as you know, most people would know, places like Rajasthan and Gujarat, the Kutch Desert, are probably the best places in India to set up solar and wind capacity. So when India decided to go the renewable way, which was actually in 2010 or so with the National Solar Mission, the government came up with a plan to set up transmission lines and evacuate power from each of these zones. So India was in fact one of the first countries in the world which said that let's set up transmission capacity in advance of generation capacity, which in fact today in hindsight was a great decision to take then, because right now we are seeing lots of new capacities coming up and not too much time taken to get the connectivity in place. So they started building transmission lines where potentially renewable energy plants could be set up. And as you would expect, they concentrated a lot of this power transmission capacity around the states of Gujarat and Rajasthan, because these were considered to be some of the best places in the country to set up renewable energy.
So these two regions are extremely important for India to reach its target of 500 gigawatts of installed renewable capacity by 2030.
There are only three pockets in this country where land is available at this scale. One is the Rajasthan belt, second is Kutch, and third is Ladakh, where these are uninhabited places with really good solar radiation. If we remove Rajasthan and Kutch from the equation, it's not a question of delaying the delaying our renewable energy targets. We would just not be able to get there.
Okay, Shravan, but what about the solution suggested? Laying of transmission lines underground and not overground?
it's important to understand why are transmission lines overground in the first place, right? We all know that transmission lines are a bit of an eyesore. So why didn't somebody just think of putting it under the ground? Why was this not the starting position to begin with? And the answer to that, very surprisingly, is not cost. The answer to that is technical losses. The losses are much higher when they are converted to cables and laid under the earth. And the second reason for that is increased maintenance, because you'd expect that transmission lines have to be in place for multiple decades. So it's important for you to have access, ready access to them, which is why transmission lines are overground.
But there is also a cost involved, right?
There's a cost involved. Of course, there's a cost involved in undergrounding transmission lines. And the cost, a lot of developers and a lot of developer associations have pegged that number at 55,000 crores. Now, as this build out actually would take place.
Sorry to interrupt. 55,000 crore to have underground transmission line across the 99,000 square kilometers of area?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Okay.
These are contracted projects. These are projects which are selling power to utilities under long-term projects. And the contract, each of these contracts specifies that if there is an increase in cost, that cost would be passed through to the procurer of power and would eventually be socialized by passing it on in the electricity bills of the consumers. So if it was a question of investing 55,000 crores more, I'm sure that this would not have gone back into the review mode or into curative mode or whatever it is that eventually happened. The problem is more practical. The problem is that undergrounding of the scale has never been attempted anywhere in this world. So we're talking about extremely large scale undergrounding taking place across large tranches of desert land. Typically, undergrounding takes place in very land scarce urban areas like Mumbai, for example, or Delhi. So where you don't have space to erect overground lines, you underground these lines. It happens in very low voltage lines, and it happens typically point to point. Not like this, that you have hundreds of kilometers of undergrounding happening under the, you know, desert.
And what were the technical losses involved?
Yes. So basically, whenever any transmission line, you know, it's a law of physics that whenever transmission takes place across distances, there are certain losses that take place during the transmission of power, which means that if I transmit to begin with 100 units of power, only 99 units will reach, or only 98 units will reach, because certain units got lost due to transmission. So while that number has not been quantified, because frankly, no one got that far, we expect that the losses, transmission losses from something like undergrounding would be something like five times. In fact, that's also the Honorable Supreme Court has also taken note of that number. It's a validated number by government agencies that the transmission losses for undergrounding of transmission lines is five times that of overground transmission lines.
What kind of investment has already been done, been made in the Thar and Kutch regions by, you know, renewable energy firms in setting up infrastructure?
So what happened after 2021 was that most of the transmission lines, so basically the way these projects are built is that only the last mile connectivity is set up by the renewable energy firm, which means that if I have a project, the 10 kilometer transmission line or the 8 kilometer transmission line till the nearest substation is laid by the renewable energy firm. That's it. The substation as well as the line beyond that, which is basically, it could be 100 kilometer, 200 kilometer till the nearest consumption point or into the larger grid. That line is laid by what we call the central transmission utility, which is a government-owned entity. Now, this government-owned entity calls tenders and, you know, has processes in place. What we saw happened after 2021 was that they slowed down the process of, because there was really no clarity on how exactly this undergrounding is going to be done. So they slowed down the process of tendering, and a lot of areas that were GIB covered, the new transmission lines which were to come up, were in fact shelved. And those lines were not built in the first place. So for the last 3 years, we looked at a scenario where those lines were in fact getting perpetually delayed year on year, because of which the renewable energy firms could not come and set up their projects there in the first place, because there was no transmission lines to evacuate the power.
Now, in its recent judgment, the court has modified its earlier order. So now there's no blanket direction for undergrounding power lines in that vast area as it was before. So how do you now see this case panning out?
Right. So what the Supreme Court has done now is that they have restricted their deliberation. So they have appointed an expert committee. They have rightly noted that it's not in their domain to figure out whether transmission lines should be overground or underground. They have empowered a committee to take that decision. But while empowering that committee also, they have not extended that scope to the GIB potential area. So this comes as a big relief, not only for developers, but it also, and the committee that has been proposed, if you see, it has only one representative from the Ministry of Renewable Energy. It has a lot of representation from the Ministry of Environment. It has conservation experts and things like that. I think the Supreme Court has now decided that, look, we will reduce this area for sure, but we will also give adequate representation for wildlife experts to suggest on what is the right methodology for conservation of the GIB. And that is hopefully a deliberation that will happen over the next 2-3 months.
While Shravan's hopes may soon be realized, the issue of construction versus conservation is, of course, much deeper. Here's Kanchi Kohli, a researcher, educator, and communicator of environmental law and policy.
I think what we need to do is understand that the verdict on renewable energy and renewable energy expansion impacting both human and wildlife habitats and homesteads has been out there for a very long time. And over a period of time, you realize with large-scale renewable energy expansion, you have large tracts of what are, in fact, common lands, whether it's fishing grounds or pastoral grounds, which also have a very important ecological habitats, breeding spaces, which are in many ways homes for bird species, other kinds of species. You will automatically be interfering with that. Some of these habitats are also have a very important socio-ecological components. In fact, these habitats are in wetland areas where there is certain very, very unique kind of fishing, of unique kind of pastoral or agriculture. So in many ways, what I'm trying to say is that when one is imagining impacts, don't imagine 1, 2, 3, 4 birds or 1, 2, 3, 4 human beings.
Absolutely.
One has to imagine space. And these renewable energy expansions or any kinds of infrastructure projects are not operating in empty spaces. They are important for all kinds of bird life, other kinds of ecological species, socio-ecological ecosystems. So I think in many ways, renewable energy planners, as well as businesses and governments will have to imagine renewable energy expansion in a very different way. Ideally, this should have been done much earlier, but now that it's, the verdict is out there, let's not delegitimize good projects or the idea of clean energy by creating the same impacts, say, other kinds of energy projects have had in the future, in the past.
I asked Kanchi how she reacts to the renewable company's argument that it's impossible for them to move geographies, to move out of Rajasthan and Gujarat.
One of the fundamental problems or challenges in this way of understanding the climate discourse has been that it's been for the longest extremely energy and emission centric. So you are actually being able to calculate moving from one energy source to another, which means you have to move from one geography to another. However, from what the challenge has been that the human rights and socio-ecological aspects of the climate discourse have come too late in the story. In fact, in some senses, I may extend myself and say it's almost been an afterthought to say that, okay, now that we are rolling out these projects, when the rubber has hit the road, now all these problems are coming in the way of clean energy expansion, which includes solar and wind and other energy sources. Now, instead of thinking of this as a downstream problem that needs to be managed, if this had always thought of, we had always imagined this to be to upstream the idea of understanding human rights, socio-ecological aspects, climate justice, upstreaming this in the planning itself, because this is not a peripheral issue, right? And if it's going to be saying that one, these are the only geographies that are important for renewable energy expansion, these are also the only geographies important for certain kinds of fish species, certain kinds of cultural aspects of, for people, livelihood sources, homes. So you isolating these as in silos doesn't help any of the causes.
Coming up in this episode, the landmark judgment from the Supreme Court recognizing the fundamental right against climate change. Now, it's important to understand that India currently does not have any climate law, which is a massive gap considering its annual greenhouse gas emissions are the third highest in the world. While the country has made significant strides in achieving its sustainability targets, it lags the world in climate litigation. In fact, the United Nations Environment Programme's climate litigation report in 2023 showed that out of 1,522 cases filed in 10 jurisdictions in the world, India filed only 11 and stood at 10th place behind Australia that had filed 127 cases, the United Kingdom that had filed 79, Canada, Brazil, New Zealand, Germany, France, and Spain. At the same time, the country's judiciary has been perhaps the most active constitutional pillar in furthering the cause of preserving the environment and combating climate change. Right from the 1985 Doon Valley case, where the right to live in a healthy environment as part of the right to live with human dignity was first recognized, to the Supreme Court's latest judgment, the judiciary has done its bit and also nudged the executive from inaction on environmental and climate-related issues. To understand the latest judgment, I spoke to environmental lawyer Shibani Ghosh, starting with the most basic question. What does it take for a right to become a fundamental right?
Right, Anirban, so as you probably know, the Constitution of India in Chapter 3 enumerates a list of rights which are considered fundamental rights. And the reason they're called fundamental is that according to the Constitution, no law can be made passed by Parliament or Legislative Assembly which is not in consonance with any of those rights. And if they're not, then those laws are void. So that's what kind of pushes a right up to that level of being a fundamental right. Now, what has happened over the years is that the Supreme Court of India has kind of interpreted other rights into what are enumerated or listed rights in the Constitution. So what we mean is that, for instance, example of Article 21, nobody's right to life can be taken away or liberty can be taken away except by procedure prescribed by law. So what's often called the right to life. But the Supreme Court of India has interpreted that right to life to mean many more things. And in the environmental context, it has meant things like the right to clean and health, clean environment, right to unpolluted air, right to ecological balance, and now most recently the right against adverse impacts of or adverse effects of climate change. So what happens is the court has interpreted it to be part of one of the fundamental rights. And the latest one is an example of that.
Another very, very basic question. So it would not require change or an amendment in the Constitution, right, to make this a fundamental right?
No. So because law declared by the Supreme Court is basically binding on all courts, and therefore if the Supreme Court has declared that this is a fundamental right, then it is a fundamental right. It does not require an amendment to the Constitution.
Just whose right is it? And so for example, if it's my right to be protected against the adverse impact of climate change, how do I exercise that right?
Right. So, I mean, there are two different questions here, Anirban. One is, whose right is it and how do you exercise that right? Now, actually, that's really an open question here, given the nature of climate change and its impacts. Because not only are current generations going to face it, future generations are going to face it as well. So can someone from the current generation file a case in court for the likely violation of rights of future generation, the unborn child, of minors. So in that sense, I must also tell you that the Supreme Court, as well as the high courts and the National Green Tribunal in India, and I'm saying this, of course, in the environmental context, have defined what is called in law the locus standi, or who has the standing to approach the court, and therefore kind of answering your question as to who who has the right and who can approach the court. This has been interpreted very liberally by our courts. And what I mean by that is that you don't have to be directly affected by, say, a project or its adverse impacts, or you don't have to be directly affected by a decision of the court in an environmental policy. As long as you can come to court and say that I'm coming to court with clean hands and therefore there's no malafides, and that I'm representing either the environment or a vulnerable group or a marginalized community who cannot speak for themselves, and therefore I'm representing a cause, that's something that the courts have been very open to. And that's, in that sense, it's, this right gives, you know, it's quite wide in terms of the who all can approach the courts.
Talking about the Ranjit Singh case, Shibani, it's ironic and rare that renewable energy firms and protectors of the forest are at opposing ends of a legal debate.
Well, I think, yes, you're right that it is not the conventional idea of an environmental case where we usually see it's in courts development, in courts versus environment is how it's often the conflict is placed. But it is not unusual for the Supreme Court to go into a balancing exercise. And it has done so previously as well. So, for instance, are you going to look at access to forest resources by forest dwellers versus do we need to protect a national park or a wildlife sanctuary from intervention, from human intervention? And there it's kind of the social rights, livelihood rights versus environmental rights. So here also you're not seeing like a, you know, an industry versus a David versus Goliath kind of story.
In your paper titled Litigating Climate Claims in India, you have pointed towards how the judiciary has pushed environmental responsibility and governance through the years. Surely that's a good sign.
Right. So when I've written about that, Anirban, what I'm referring to, that there have been certain decisions from National Green Tribunal, for instance, where the National Green Tribunal has kind of asked the executive to move towards policy making on climate issues. And I think in the paper, what I argue is really that more than climate governance, Anirban, is environmental governance. And I think that's where I could come to the second part of your question as to how the court has played an active role on environmental governance in the country. Now, for instance, if you look at issues of air quality, if you look at issues of forest governance, we've had these long-running cases in the Supreme Court starting from the 1980s and the 1990s, which are still heard. And just finally, more recently, the court is talking about, and in fact, Chief Justice Chandrachur has spoken about this in many of his judgments, the environmental rule of law. And he is, in fact, one of the key parts of that is institutional robustness, which I think is a very important contribution of the court, saying that if environmental governance in the country has to be improved, we have to have our environmental regulators, whether, for instance, it's the pollution control boards or it's the coastal zone management authorities or it's the Department of Environment. And we have so many of these environmental regulators, and they have to function in a particular manner which is in consonance or compliance with the environmental rule of law.
And yet we are still lagging the world as far as climate litigation is concerned, as the UNEP climate litigation report also showed. Now, where do we stand, and is this recent judgment a good way forward?
So Anirban, first of all, historically, climate litigation is, I mean, if you look at UNEP itself, the numbers in the United States are much higher, right? It's about 70% of climate litigation in the whole world would be United States. So, you know, you're removing that whole chunk. And then you have, you know, Australia, European Union, Canada, I mean, more of the, which may be called the global north in some senses, them kind of leading the way. A lot of cases which scholars are identifying as climate litigation in the global south were not traditionally considered climate litigation because they were thought that, okay, climate is only on the periphery of these cases. But as increasingly academics are arguing that in the global south, where the concerns are very different, particularly, you know, development imperatives are different, these countries are at a very different level of human, at the, in terms of, you know, economic factors, social factors, education factors, all of those, global south is at a very different place. Their environmental rights, some of them have very new constitutions, their regulatory structures are very different. There you can the comparison kind of breaks down. And therefore, they are saying that here in the global south, you have to define climate litigation in a slightly broader way to include cases where climate is being raised as an argument. You cannot right now expect or there are very few cases in the global south, including in India, where climate is the core issue. Whereas in the US and, you know, many of the European Union nations, you will see that climate is a core issue. So it's very easy to identify them as climate litigation cases. In India, you can't do that. So I think India, given that, one, it's one of the more vulnerable countries, given our demography, given our geography. Two, it's an extremely vocal player, vocal participant in international negotiations. And India is willing to, you know, be active in this issue, on this issue of climate change. So in that sense, I think India is likely to be, or that we are likely to see more cases coming up in India. Having said all that, Anirban, if I could just put in a few caveats. One is, many climate cases are issues where it is, it's a government policy, right? Many of these issues, there have been judgments of the Supreme Court where the Supreme Court has said, look, this is not our job. This is something the executive, a democratically elected government, has decided. We are not entering this space of policymaking and executive decision making. That's not our jurisdiction. The second caveat is that our courts, as they are for every other type of case, are overburdened and they have an overflowing docket. Mm-hmm. So if we get a little excited that, wow, we're going to have more and more climate cases, let's just remember that decisions and judgments and judicial outcomes take a while in India. So this judgment of the Chief Justice is landmark because it has identified the right. But let us not think that, you know, from tomorrow, we are going to have everyone's right against adverse effects of climate change being upheld and, you know, enforced and protected.
And finally, I asked Kanchi that at a time when forests are being mercilessly cut, despite protests like the one ongoing in Hastio to protect its forest from mining activity, will this judgment from the Supreme Court truly protect individuals that are being impacted by climate change?
This judgment is actually landmark. It's important to be able to see it, that courts are beginning to recognize adverse impacts of climate change and equate it to your right to life and equality. So one has to see this at the beginning of a new phase of jurisprudence in courts. Having said that, I think if we locate this in two aspects, one, there is the road from judgments to actually realizing the meaning of that judgment on the ground, even in specific cases where liability has very clearly been established, is pretty long. There are challenges, there are enforcement issues, there are bureaucracies, there is politics, all those kinds of factors definitely come on board. The second is, I think, in the case of climate change, when already you have a history of how attribution and liability is extremely difficult to establish in very localized environmental and socio-ecological questions, in the case of climate, I think this is going to be even more difficult to do. For instance, who is responsible for large-scale renewable expansion in the country? Is it the government who should be held liable? Is it the private producer? Is it the contractor? Who is it? That is going to be held liable for the planning of something like this? Or for that matter, it has to be the global north, which you are trying to think of common but differentiated responsibilities. So it's going to be a long road before one is able to realize the meaning of some of these judgments in specific cases. Be able to give relief to people or be able to restore habitats. So I think that's definitely going to be a long path. But if you see this as an import, as one piece of the puzzle to be able to address some of these issues, and also recognize that this is not going to be enough, recognize that these are not empty spaces in which you're going to be doing emissions reduction, including climate solutions like carbon sinks, creating new carbon sinks. Only then one will be able to come up with holistic solutions, or even start imagining holistic solutions, start imagining trade-offs with a recognition that these are as core issues as emissions reduction or as economic prosperity of a country.
Legend has it that when a newly independent India was deciding on its national symbols, the great Indian bustard had almost been chosen as its national bird. It was dropped for fear of the unparliamentary wordplay that would emanate from its name. Well, recognized or not, the great Indian bustard is absolutely a mighty representative of India's flora and fauna. But where do you think it stands today? A colleague of mine who's in Rajasthan to cover the upcoming elections asked a local politician about the plight of the great bird. In mock seriousness, he asked, "Kitne bache hain? 50? 100?" That's the kind of apathy the great Indian bustard's facing in its own habitat. In Dr. M.K. Ranjit Singh, there's at least someone willing to pick up the good fight for the big bird. Now, this one is possibly a lost battle. But the war is still on, in the form of numerous scattered conflicts to protect our forests and wildlife. Recognizing the fundamental right against climate change is a great start by the judiciary. But other pillars of the democracy have to ensure that the right can be exercised. Only then can there be balance between progress and preservation. That's it for today. You were listening to this episode on The Morning Brief. It was produced by Surohini Jain and Vinay Joshi, sound designed by Amrit Reggie. Big thanks to my colleague Neil Ghai, biologist Sumit Dukia, and Samyuk Sridharan, co-founder of Ripple and an avid bird enthusiast, for the research that included helping identify the call of the very reticent GIB that you heard at the beginning of the episode. Thank you to my colleague and ET's energy ace Kalpana Pathak for her inputs. Do like, share and subscribe if you like the episode. The Morning Brief drops every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday on a listening platform of your choice. Keep listening. All clips used in this episode belong to their respective owners. Credits are mentioned in the description.